as long as they got us in chains. Putting a foot down to my chest, most of this life's nothing but pain. And I'm fiending till there's nothing left. I'm scheming on the way to pay my debts. And when the demons call, ain't seeing y'all. Ghost in the house, I sleep with y'all. When you see me coming, you better start off running. Me beat the war drum and jumping till there's a beat. And we know that we done it, yeah. I'm nothing nice, don't make me tell you what I told you twice. We dream blind and diamond kite, boots up and the sun is burning bright. Seen fly by with days that's borrowed. We all know there's no tomorrow. And that's just how it goes. Everybody knows, everybody knows. Everybody goes, everybody dies. We can still look in each other's eyes. Leaving the shackles of measurable time. Watching the sacks of the calendars climb. Light bitch on your skin. What do you regret about where you've been? Did you fear God and hide your sins? We be scared when the light goes dim. Then we close our eyes. Never knew sorrow again. Walking the stars. Feel that thoughts. To go with the breath in my lungs and shed my dirty skin. Yeah.
We are the ones that made it here. And we are.
To keep us silent, big crushings in the palms of giants. No love, cause I was born defiant. Caught fighting in a system of violence. Stop, stop telling me that I gotta be somebody I'm not. That I gotta vote for another damn joke. That I never represent my thoughts. That I gotta sit back and sigh when I see another youth get shot by cops. Been locked up like many other motherfuckers with the same last name I got. They've always been teaching us lessons about how a fight is not worth it. In hopes that we won't disturb them. Came up with a couple of gods and laws to worship. We service the servants that burn us at every sermon. That make many governments work. But none of us understand that we got power to stop anything that's not worth it. In the past, been enslaved. Once greater, but God that never saved. Never raised no minimum wage. Another boss that never managed to properly pay. But I'm on my long grind. Cutting off tight strings, struggling neck, black ties. And it might be a pipe dream, but I wanna believe this world could be better than what it seems. See, in the end, when the light's dim, it's not about the skin that we're in. It's about what we do when we live. We can rise, we get bigger than we think. As we lift little fists to the sky, like a five, I'm crying. Oh,
we are the ones that made it here. And we are.
Y'all saying, cut that string, feeling impatient. So much pain in my heart, I can taste it. Yeah, world's got mad, just face it. Raise that fist clench on your chest. Where did the everything, please take a breath. Hold it so hold it that no one can help you. In time moves slowly, you don't even know me. I can feel sunlight on my bleeding tongue. Live shit quick on a loaded gun. Color my skin the waves of rainbow, transfuse alien blood. Give me a drug, give me a clue, give me a taste of what y'all do. We could all spin in a canvas and color the masterpiece. But what is your truth?
We are the ones that made it here.
Fuck the police.
Fuck the police.
All right, once again, it's time for This Going Down podcast. Today, we're joined with none other than Franklin Lopez. Frank is part of the Submedia Project. If you go to It's Going Down, I know you've seen It's the End of the World as We Know It and I Feel Fine. It is Frank and Submedia's ongoing show that recently just ended. But if you're sad about the show coming to a close, rest assured that Frank and company are coming back with an even more hard-hitting project. It's called Trouble. It will be released in a few days, the very first episode, and it features footage and a documentary. It's 30 minutes long about the No Dapple struggle at Standing Rock. So We're all at the edge of our seats waiting for this thing to drop. I know it's going to be great. I'm really excited. We also know that the next episode will be on anti-fascism and will feature interviews with people from in the United States and Canada and across the world. So we're also very excited about that. We're excited where this project is gonna go and expand. And we're really excited to talk with Frank today about the state of anarchist media, about IGD Crime Think, and some media all working together, about an upcoming podcast network that's forming called Channel Zero, and about a lot of other stuff. We really get into also the ins and outs of Quebec nationalism, what it's like in Montreal, the state of the anarchist movement there, indigenous struggles, and much more. So thanks for a lot for Frank for coming on. Let's get into it. Thanks a lot for listening. Okay, so we're joined here today with Frank from Some Media. Frank, you're going on all these other shows, the Soulcast, Final Straw, great stuff. So I guess the pressure's on to make this like Inside the Actor Studio or something on this show. But
gotta do the circuit.
Let's just get into it. I mean, you're talking about launching a new show called Trouble. How long is this show going to be? Is it 30 minutes or is it an hour?
It's 30 minutes because we're not that stupid. 30 minutes being plenty of work for a small crew to produce. But actually, as I was talking to a comrade, it's a reduction of what we were producing last time. Our previous show, It's the End of the World as We Know It and I Feel Fine, well, it came out twice a month, and then each show was about 20 to 25 minutes, depending. So it's a bit of a work cut for us in a sense, but in another sense, is we're striving for a little higher production value, and we're not doing Skype interviews and stuff like that. We're actually hiring shooters in different locations to actually shoot the interviews for us, so they look all better and nice. It's a 30-minute monthly documentary show that will come out like clockwork on the last Sunday of every month, so that people can plan on watching it at home. But the main goal is for people to watch it in groups, whether it be small gatherings of friends, or screenings at community centers, bookstores, church basements, libraries, what have you.
And this will still come out on the site, just like the show. It'll just pop up and you'll be able to watch it on the site.
Yeah, absolutely. The only difference is that we're hoping that people who want to screen the show, mm-hmm. Sign up to become troublemakers. That the show is called Trouble, right? And it's two prong. One is troublemakers pay $10 a month, and that's a way for to help us sustain our production. But also they will get like an advanced link to the show, and they can start screening the show from the Friday before it comes out. So you can set up a screening ahead of the online release. But then on that Sunday at 8 p.m., like clockwork, people can watch it from there on end.
Because I think I've been seeing little like Facebook links and stuff like that pop up for this Friday. There's people showing it. I think in Montreal, people are watching it on Friday.
On Montreal, we're watching it on Saturday, actually. But there's a screening in Carrboro, I believe, on Friday. There's a screening in Denver, Colorado, on Friday as well. And I'm not sure. We actually didn't even really make the call out for the troublemakers, and people were already requesting to do screenings in advance. So even if people haven't signed up, we're just as a one off, we're offering this up to people who may want to do screenings this weekend.
Yeah, and just to put it out there is a call for a week of solidarity with Standing Rock, Sacramento, Washington, D.C. arrestees, anybody that's been arrested kind of in the last couple months after Trump has come in, from April 1st to the 7th, take action, hold events, anything you can think of. So this would be a great thing that people could do, easy event. Show the film, get people talking. But you're saying on the 26th of March, it will be available on the site if people want to just stream it off the website.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think people who come to the site on Sunday are going to have a pretty pleasant surprise. Crossing fingers, because we're still working on it. But the hope is that by Sunday night, you're going to arrive at a brand fucking new sub-media site that's going to look like Netflix. You're going to be able to like... It's like Netflix for anarchists. You're gonna kick back and watch like hundreds of videos. and with the goal of more than just being a video channel is to give people an option to, you know, at the end of the day, instead of watching some Hollywood shit, you can go there and watch documentaries, watch stuff that's gonna enrich your brain and your soul, and not some stereotypical Hollywood nonsense.
Is it going to have videos beyond the Submedia catalog? It's going to have all types of other stuff, or?
Yeah, absolutely. We're going to have documentaries. We're going to have we're going to feature work of other independent filmmakers. Like, I don't know if people are aware of the folks from Global Uprisings, but we're going to be featuring their stuff as well. Mm-hmm. And also, we're going to be asking people to submit videos, whether it is videos that they created or if they know of something good that's already streaming online. And that way, we can just basically, more than just we could be like a place that kind of sorts through these things and creates like a pretty good database of visual content that people can actually watch and not have to like search online like, oh, I want to find out about anarchism, and then you get stuck with like a whole bunch of anarcho-capitalist nonsense, which is basically what happens in YouTube, right? And happens in the podcast world as well.
We're actually going to talk about anarcho-capitalists later today. We're going to bring that up. But let's go back to the beginning. I was thinking today before we did this interview, is like, I can't even remember when I first saw Submedia. I feel like it's almost always been there. But I mean, what pushed you to start Submedia, and kind of just what was that initial thing inside you that just said like, this has to happen?
Well, this is a bit of a funny/embarrassing story, but Submedia actually officially started in 1994. It was called Subversive Media back then, but then my friends prodded me to make a shorter name. But I was a marijuana activist back then. This is when you laugh.
All right. Gotcha.
And so the first project that I wanted to do was I wanted to create like a CD-ROM version but with video of I don't know if anybody knows Jack Harar's The Emperor Wears No Clothes, but for people who don't know, it's an underground book that is more like a hodgepodge collection of newspaper clippings from the turn of the 20th century all the way up to, you know, whatever the last edition is, about marijuana and hemp and everything has to do with the cannabis plant, and trying to show people that, you know, prohibition is fucked up, like, and how prohibition actually came to be. And and for me, that was super exciting. That was sort of one of my first sort of exposures to independent media, and I thought that's information needed to get out there. So I started Subversive Media initially as a vehicle to get what we call the hemp cyclopedia out. And it took 4 years for that to actually get off the ground. But we did a couple of projects in between then, a film about sexual assault, some music videos as well. But it was not until like the internet really fully came into its own that we decided to start publishing videos online. In 2001, after 9/11, I became fully immersed in the anti-war movement against the war in Afghanistan, or the coming war in Afghanistan. And I met people from Indie Media in Indie Media Atlanta, where I was living at the time. Mm-hmm. And I got introduced to anarchist ideas. And from there, in 2003, Submedia released their first official anarchist film called Join the Resistance, Fall in Love, based on Crime Think chapter in the book Days of War, Nights of Love. Mm-hmm. And so I would say that the current incarnation of Submedia as a anarchist and a radical media production crew really starts in the post 9/11 era, and really started calling itself an anarchist media crew in 2003.
Did you reach out to Crime Think and said, hey, by the way, we're gonna do, because you did that one, and then you did actually one of my favorite short films, the Why I Love Shoplifting from Big Corporations. Did you reach out to them and said, hey, we're gonna make a video out of this?
No, No, I did not. And one of the things that I loved about Crying Think, but also that I loved about the folks that I met in the media, was this whole idea that intellectual property was bullshit and that nobody should really own ideas. And in the media, they call that copyleft. But in that same book that Crying Think put out, they really made an appeal to people to basically take that book and sign it and publish it as your own in your own name if you wanted to, you know, to modify it. So they were really into this. Maybe they didn't see it in the same language, but in this sort of remix mashup culture. And mm-hmm. so I really took that to heart, and I thought, well, you know, this would be I think that maybe it'll be a cool thing if I just make the film and then I show it to them. And maybe I can join their super secretive underground anarchist crew. And so I did. I sent it to them, and it took a while before they replied, and they told me it was rad. And to me, who I just never lived in the West Coast, to me was like, is that it? That's all they're gonna say? It's rad? But then somebody told me, it's like, no, man, in the West Coast, if somebody says it's rad, it means that they really like it.
That's so funny.
Yeah. So then I made the shoplifting thing again without talking to them, just basically did it all on my own, and they were really happy about that one as well. And but yeah, after that, I just started, you know, producing content on a more regular basis. And in 2006, after a short stint at a Democracy Now!, I decided to do my own fucking new show.
And let's talk about that, because you've brought that up a lot of times, that you worked on Democracy Now!, but if you can kind of like take us in the sausage factory, I mean, what was it like working there? Because I mean, I definitely look at their capacity and like their ability to pump out a news show every day, and it's like, fuck, you know, that's where I want to be, you know, that's where I would like to go at some point, you know, just to have that capacity. And also just, you know, a lot of people, even a lot of people that might be like, yeah, their politics are, you know, definitely on the left side, you know, maybe a little bit progressive or whatever, but I mean, they still use it as a huge resource. So I'm just curious, like, what was it like working at Democracy Now!, and just what did you do, and what was your experience like?
Well, to start with, I was a video producer, and so there was three video producers full time and one video producer part time, and I was one of the full time ones. And our job was to basically deal with all the visual content, anything you saw on screen, we had a responsibility on it. It's probably one of the most intense work experience I have had, but also rewarding, particularly because as anybody who's been doing like independent media or even activist work for a while, you know, you come across a lot of flakes, you come across a lot of people who are a lot of talk, and then you finally find people that you're really good to work with. You want to hold on to them forever, like, you know, like Heat Score, my partner at Submedia now, like that fucker's, I'm never letting him go. He's amazing. I hope he knows that. But at Democracy Now!, everybody there was fucking dedicated as fuck, and it's the only way to make, you know, a show like that work. You know, I worked my ass off, like, you know, second time actually living in New York City, and I never really saw the city, because when I was not working, I was sleeping, you know, that was basically my reality. But what Amy Goodman and her crew had shown is that is possible, but it is only possible because they're taking a long view, and they started small and they grew. And so when we think about these projects and we want to get to that level where, you know, this lefty or sort of lefty news show that reaches millions of people on a daily basis, which is no small feat, was done over a period of like over 20 years now, right?
Right.
And so I think that we should take it as inspiration. If we don't like the politics, or we think the politics should go further left, we should just shut the fuck up and make our own media.
Right.
Which is basically what I did, and what like many other people do, right? Is you know, they chose that, to take that route and do a lot more sort of Washington politics type stuff. That shouldn't stop us, you know, and yeah, certainly we should have our critiques, and that's not that's always valid. You know, I'm the first one to make critiques of them, but at the same time, sort of understanding that at great odds, they have done not only a massive endeavor for this daily audio video news show, but also it's based in New York fucking city. You know, that's also like a big feat, right? Like that's like they're right in the heart of like media creation world. And now they're a contender, you know, now you would hear them mentioned in mainstream media, which never used to happen before. They were constantly ignored as sort of like activist media, right?
Right. Exactly. Well, that kind of brings me to my next question. Just when you were doing some media, like, because a lot of times I feel like these media projects are kind of like you're pushing a boulder up a hill, and at some point you kind of hit a spot where it's like you can kind of like start to feel it move. You know, you can feel the momentum. When you were doing some media, when It's the End of the World as We Know It started, what was the point where you could really start to feel the momentum build? Like, you know, we've really got something at this point.
I think it was around the Democratic National Convention and Republican conventions in Denver and in St. Paul in 2008. Mm-hmm. I was doing this show from my tiny apartment in Vancouver at the time, without any sort of real solid contact with the rest of the world. I knew I had some decent numbers, way better than I ever thought that I would. But it was not until that summer of 2008 that I went on a little tour of the Midwest, partly so that I could visit Minneapolis, St. Paul, and see what people were doing there to set up an independent media space, which nobody was really working on that. And so I got in touch with folks there, and we started laying the groundwork for making independent media during the RNC. But through that tour is when I realized that, holy shit, there's all these people who know about the show who will come to these little screenings here and there.
Right.
And it gave me a real sense of the impact that it was having on the radical community. And so when I went to Denver and St. Paul, people were telling me, like, holy shit, you would not believe this. Like, every day after the protest, people gather around and they watch, you know, they watch what actually happened that day, and it served as a way to bring up I'm thinking in Spanish right now. To bring up the spirit of people who maybe have been brutalized by the cops or chased out, or, you know, convergence spaces raided, or et cetera, you know. Mm-hmm. But people felt that the people, like especially anarchists and more radical folks, felt that there was somebody who was covering their struggle in their words, using imagery that they're used to, using riot porn, cursing, all these different things. And so I sort of got, when the RNC and the DNC ended, I just wanted to quit because I was so fucking burnt out. And I put out a message basically saying that I was gonna maybe making the last show for a while, just until like I got my shit together. At the same time, I was getting divorced around the same time. And so it was sort of this convergence of like the extreme paranoia and fear that we were feeling, especially in St. Paul. So many comrades were being arrested and so many cops in the streets. And
every day, yeah.
Every day, then crossing borders back into Canada and all these different things. And I just wanted to take a break. And there was an outpouring of anger from people saying,
how dare you stop doing that thing?
Fuck you. You can't quit. And I was like, you guys are misunderstanding me. But at the same time, it had a really good effect in just showing me that that there was a sizable group of people out there who were needing this content to come out.
Yeah, sometimes you don't realize how much it means until you stop doing it for a while, and then people start screaming at you, like, do that thing you do all the time now. You can't stop.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things I've been thinking a lot about, you know, because we look at these bigger media conglomerates, whether it's CNN, you know, MSNBC, Fox News, so on and so forth, or kind of these like growing insurgent right sources like InfoWars or Breitbart. You know, we look at them and like, oh, they've got all these resources. But if you look back to anarchist media, it does seem, though, now that things are more centralized in a couple projects. Like, I think the level of what people are working on is like much higher, like the bar has been raised, but it definitely feels like there's less news and media being produced as compared to like when the indie media network was exploding. I'm just curious if you could talk about that. Like, it just seems like, I know you've talked about this before, but just this kind of shift to social media as kind of like the way that people express what's happening. So now they'll like get on their Instagram account, whereas like 10 years ago they would have like wrote a story and put a post up or something, you know?
Yeah, I mean I think that we can't ignore social media. I mean, we hesitantly started using Facebook, partly because a fan of the show just set up a stimulator page on Facebook and eventually just gave it to us. Because we really always, and we still feel that it's really important for us to own those means of distribution, right? Like to own our own websites. The big issue that we have, not to run into a tangent, is video distribution, right? Like we really don't have the money to pay for our own bandwidth, so we're always relying on corporate and non-corporate websites like archive.org, for instance. But that said, like it's been a little disheartening, to be honest, that when the indie media project started to fold, I mean, not that it completely folded, but it doesn't really have the numbers of people that it had like back in the heyday of the anti-globalization movement, that I really expected more people to be getting their radical projects out. And sometimes, specifically as a video maker, I feel fairly lonely as a radical filmmaker that's making movement media for movements on the web. And we're now seeing how independent outlets, as you have said, as Breitbart, as Alex Jones, who started their independent media projects, the influence and the effects that they're having, like we're living them right now. I mean, this is no joke. And in a sense, maybe we should take those examples as a warning, but also as some sort of inspiration. You know, if jokers like these can make these sort of big influential projects, then we should be able to match the quality with content that's about liberation and that is not about hating on migrants or gay people or people of color, right? And so, you know, we have to get moving on this. And so here's where I'm gonna join the Mutual Admiration Club. But when y'all started, I was super happy that there was something out there that was working towards that. And you know, and then the proof is in the pudding. You know, the work that It's Going Down is doing is it's essential right now to what's going on right now, and it's being recognized not just for people on the left and anarchists and radicals, but also the mainstream media is continuously going to you as a source where anarchists go to get their news and their analysis, right? And so I think that people should understand that just because a few of us are making this, that this is enough. It's definitely not enough, and we need it all, and we need more people creating media, mm-hmm. more websites, or even at the very least, produce videos and publish it on our websites, or write analysis, or make podcasts, whatever it is, right? Because we need to reach a much larger audience than we're reaching right now. I mean, I think that when we reach the millions, then I think we can say that we're really making a larger dent in the media scape. But as you will attest, and so will Crime Think and us to a lesser degree, at this particular moment, people are are so woke, as people would say, that the Democrats are not the solution. And so people are looking for answers beside that. And that's why they come to websites like ours, because they're just like, why am I going to go to the Bernie Sanders website? That fucker just totally like backstabbed us. Why am I going to go to the Democrats? Like, you know, they completely, they're hugely responsible for everything that's happening right now. And so thankfully they're these resources that we have right now, these websites existed, but we certainly need more, and we need different flavors, you know. It doesn't have to be all looking and feeling like the stuff that we all create. You know, I think that there's a wide range of ways that people can make media that other people might be more likely to consume, right? And so sorry, I feel like I'm rambling on that point, but you know, just to sum up, I think that we should. Again, look at the effect that right-wing independent media has had in the state of the world. Right now, they have an impact that affects everybody around the world, and we should take that as a source of inspiration to make our own media.
Yeah, and I really wish, you know, like when I look at It's Going Down and like, you know, the reports for the day like trickle in, I just wish that more people were writing about what they were doing, you know, where they live, because I think that's so key right now. And it's important because people are looking at us. They are looking at what's going on. And even if people are just, you know, showing up to some event and passing out a flyer or, you know, dropping a banner or taking down, you know, Nazi stickers and putting up their own, just documenting and sharing, you know, those kind of acts of resistance, I think is really critical. And for us, you know, just for everybody that's listening to this, I really encourage them to do that more and to set up their own counter information website. You know, like in Montreal, there's Montreal Counter Information, which is a great resource, but you know, just for towns, like, you know, it's really worth it, even if you're just going to post something every month, but really set up a website and like document, you know, get some into media project going where you live and tell people what's going on.
Oh, I wholeheartedly agree. I think that the local, the global is sexy, but like people have a tremendous opportunity to make a larger splash locally. And the folks from Montreal Counter Info, as an example, have done a tremendous dent here by giving voices to people that the mainstream media will never give to, but also by really pushing the envelope as to how far they can take the radical rhetoric. And one particular neighborhood here that's a working class neighborhood called Hochelag that has been going brutal gentrification, they've been sort of like the signal fire for all the anti-gentrification action. Militant, like illegal actions against yuppie businesses and surveillance cameras and the cops, right? And so, but you know, that's at a local level, and people actually go to that website to get informed about those things, but also to learn also how to do some of the things that some of these folks who publish communiques there do it.
Yeah, we're going to talk a little bit about Montreal in a bit, but yeah, Montreal Counter Info, definitely can't rep that site enough. So let's talk a little bit about when you got to the point where you wanted to have volunteers come in. What was that process like? Because I can only imagine, you know, just basically giving birth to some media project. Well, I can't imagine giving birth to some media project and then like bringing new people in that, you know, don't have as much invested, but they want to help. Like, how do you do that? And also, how do you maintain like it as an anti-authoritarian project when you're in that level of basically, I don't want to say being the boss, but somebody that has like a, you know, certain level of control and commitment to the project, and somebody's coming in basically wanting to help? How do you keep everything horizontal when it's like that?
Well, I mean, I think the main thing is that a lot of folks who volunteer want to learn, right? And so I think that's a little bit of the trade that happens, right? And so I think that when people think about anti-authoritarian projects, I just think that there's a certain misconception about like what mentoring is, and I just don't see mentoring as a as an authoritarian position. I see it, how people have people who know a craft that have apprentices, right? And and really the only way to do that is to, you know, give people a project and show them how to do it, and then just let them run with it. And so when we call out for volunteers or whatever, we're not hoping that to have, you know, ironically, we're not hoping to have slaves that do our work for us. But what we're hoping is that people learn the skills and then maybe take them elsewhere and create their own projects. Because the reality is that we can't pay people, not at this moment. And that's the goal. Eventually, is if we're able to raise money in ways that are not going to subvert our own project and co-opt us, which is something that we're always on the lookout for. Our hope is to getting people to help us prolong our project, that we in turn hand them skills so that they can take those skills elsewhere. And so most volunteers just basically stick around for like a semester or something like that, and they go on to do other stuff. But I think it was in 2009 where I got a fairly decent size workspace in Vancouver, where I was able to have more desk space, where I had maybe three to four volunteers in one particular instance, helping me with a feature film project that I was working on at the time. And around that same time in 2010, this is where I met HeatScore, one of the folks at my other half was at Media Right Now, mm-hmm. who basically came from a different province in Canada to intern, and we created another, like our third crime think film called Steal Something from Workday, and that was basically all him. Like, you know, we talked about a concept or whatever, and he just ran with it, and it's one of my favorite submedia films that we have created. But that's the main thing, is that it's sort of understanding the trade-off, and also understanding that talking about horizontality and closed and open projects is that before we're gonna let anybody in and sit down at the table and be part of submedia, like officially, whatever the fuck that is, we want to make sure that there's trust there. We want to make sure that the people are committed and they're comrades. And so I think a lot of projects will echo this, right? Like that, you know, we need to protect our investment, the time investment, that being into these projects, because I mean, there's infiltration. There's the potential for disruption if people who you don't really know are part of your project can have a tendency to like sort of destroy things if things are not working out. And I've seen this happen. And so part of this is just my experience, right? Working in indie media, for example, being an open organization, I mean, that's one of the downfalls I saw of many indie media projects, is because since it was open, like disruptive elements could come in, and if there was no real way to sort of control that or diffuse situations, a lot of projects sort of imploded because of these sort of outside people who came in and destroyed like years and years of work, right? And yeah, so those are my thoughts. I mean, it's not perfect. As I was telling Sol during an interview I did with him last week, was that if I were to start a brand new media project, then before we even shoot the first frame of footage or edit anything, to come up with frameworks for how we're going to work together. But we've never really had the luxury of the time to do that. Like it's sort of been evolving as we're working on stuff, right?
Right.
So
yeah.
So that's a little more challenging, but you know, right now, the just full transparency, like two of us get paid for submedia, and we get paid the exact same amount of poverty wages, and we're able to make it happen partly because we live really cheap lifestyles. Like we have no no extravagant desires in terms of like champagne or caviar or any other shit. And we work from home, but we work our asses off. That's one thing for certain. And I think that's the last thing I'll say, is that people who want to do this type of stuff need to understand that, as nice and as sexy as it looks on the other end, once it comes out, it's just a fuck ton of work on the back end.
Hey, can you talk a little bit about that? I mean, just how you got to the point where you began asking for donations, and really, you know, you all doing that is what inspired us to be like, you know, we can do this full time. Can you just talk a little bit about that? Did you ever get any flack for that? Anything like, because anytime you bring money into the picture, then that's a whole nother layer on the cake, you know?
I'm sure we got flack for it. But it might have been so negligible that I just don't really even remember. I think at one point we got flack for even selling T-shirts or something like that. Mm-hmm. But you know, it's usually young folks who you know have a sort of purist sort of mentality, and they eventually get over it. But I think in 2008 was when we first put the PayPal button on the website, and it was at the behest of a buddy of mine in Vancouver who was into podcasting back then. He's like, you know, all these podcasts, they ask for donations. I don't think it's a big deal. I don't think you're subverting your ideals by doing that. And I very begrudgingly did it. Like, I was just like, ugh, okay. Because I was broke. I mean, I had stopped working for Democracy Now. I was doing like little tiny contracts for like public access television shows, which were fun, but just didn't really pay all that much. And I remember that as the months went by, because what we were doing, well, I guess I should say what I was doing back then was pretty consistent. I was putting it out like every 2 weeks, like clockwork, and the money started coming in. And you know, when I said the money started coming in, people shouldn't think like I was getting rich. You know, it's just
you're just living off of it.
Yeah, but I remember the first time the PayPal account hit $500. I was just like, holy shit. Like, I just had forgotten about it, and I checked it, and I was like, wow, that's like half of my living expenses for this month. That's fucking remarkable. And as that number grew a little bit, like, I started like laying off my clients, just basically saying like, look, I'm just going to do this other thing now, and sorry, thank you for the work. And I never ever thought that this was going to be the thing that would pay the bills for me, and let alone for two people in living in Canadian cities, right? But here we are, and I think that there's an understanding from people out there that this media is not the norm, that, you know, people who understand the crap that the mainstream is creating out there, that there's value in what we do, and that even if they give us a dollar or two a month, you know, it's worth for them to watch, like, you maybe the 60 minutes of content that we produce every month, right? And so I mean, I think that we started doing this. This is not like a way to sort of give ourselves a pat on the back, but before sort of crowdfunding became a thing, like, we were doing this, and now it's more widely accepted than when we first started doing it. And now it's like, now it ain't no thing. Like, people are like, yeah, of course, you have a podcast, you sustain yourself through donations, and that's just the way it is.
Yeah, I mean, I was looking at the Chapo Trap House podcast. Patreon is another thing that a lot of people are using now. And I think they're up to, like, Chapo Trap House, if you don't know, is like kind of like a liberal Bernie bro podcast. It's supposed to be funny. Some people don't think it's that funny. But anyway.
The name is awesome, though.
Yeah, yeah. It's kind of like just people sitting around talking shit. But anyway, they make like 50 grand a month right now, I think, is their I think they've got like five people in there. I don't know how many ways they break it up. But still, I mean, if you're making if you're making 5 to 10 grand a month on a podcast, I mean, to me, that's incredible. But I mean, yeah, I think definitely like things like Patreon are definitely a way to go. I think in our next month, that's kind of where we're going to start transitioning, because I think, like you were saying, the kind of the next hill to climb for us is like, how do we start beyond just the people that are just doing the day-to-day shit? How do we start paying, like, basically, I don't want to say it like this, but, you know, throwing money at people, like giving them money to like submit and do work, because a lot of people at this point, you know, can't really sit down and contribute that much if they're not getting paid, you know.
But even think about this. Like, recently we had to do an interview not in Montreal, and we couldn't travel to this place. Mm-hmm. And we were approaching some videographers, and one videographer said, like, look, I get paid a lot to do the things that I do, but I never get to do shit like this cool. Like that, you know, talking about like anti-fascist organizing, for instance. And so there's people who are just happier that they're not going to be doing the fucking soul sucking work of working for like an ad agency or working, you know, people who are, I mean, I'm talking from the sort of film and video production world, that they're actually doing something that matters. And so even that, just throwing $100 to this videographer who would usually pay like $400 or $500 to do a shoot like that, is, you know, it just made their day. And so I think that there's opportunities there to get people doing more meaningful work with the skills that they have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally. So just thinking with your new project, I mean, what are kind of the barriers that you want to like break right now? Because I mean, it's the end of the world as we know it, and I Feel Fine has like, I don't know if you want to break down the numbers, but I mean, there's a lot of people that watch that show. So with Trouble, I mean, what kind of star are you reaching for? Like, where do you hope to go with this? And like what could take it to the next level, do you think, for as far as the audience size or whatever?
Well, I mean, I honestly have not thought in that sense, because like the star, I should put it, that we want to reach is maybe super idealistic, you know, in a classic sort of anarchist daydreaming fashion. Mm-hmm. We'd like people to step away from their computers, and I know that's probably like a far-fetched goal, but it's harder to quantify those numbers, as a lot of people probably, I mean, it happens all the time. People screen our work and don't tell us, so we don't really know how many people are actually having little film screenings here and there with our stuff. But that's the main goal, is that people use our work to have like an easy event to do. I think that people who, especially who live in smaller cities or bigger towns or whatnot, have a problem setting up events, because they don't really, you know, radical speakers might not come to their part of the town or et cetera. And here we're creating a sort of ready-made event for you that you just basically like throw up a couple of flyers, and you know, even if 20 people show up, like to me that's a success, especially if people get to talking and people get to know each other, and eventually people start to conspire together to exactly. to join them fucking resistance, right? And so that, to me, that would be the biggest star, is moving people away from the atomization of computer screens and into the real world. But if I were to think bigger, maybe the production value that we'll reach, maybe not in the first year or so, but like in years to come, I'm not opposed to a television contract, some small like free speech TV or even other like sort of cable channels to sort of rebroadcast our stuff, or even I mean, if you really think about it, to bring it back to Democracy Now, one big part of their success was that the grassroots distribution network that they created was essentially built on community radio, public and public access television, right? And so I think that building a type of network, a similar network like that for our own content would be fantastic. So our show will be made into an audio version as well, a 30-minute audio version. Set on that the show is going to be the same length every single time. It's going to be 28 minutes and 30 seconds, except for the first version, since we don't have any broadcasters right now. But all the shows are going to be exact length so that can fit a radio and a television format, and the hopes that we can create a sort of more grassroots distribution network aside from the what we're calling trouble spots, which are the small.
That's awesome.
The small community theaters or right. community centers or info shops or whatnot.
Yeah, I mean, do you have any thoughts on that? I mean, you know, I know what Free Speech TV is. If you don't know, it's Free Speech TV is it's kind of a mix. There's like very progressive, even kind of like liberal stuff, and then there's stuff that's pretty radical. I remember at one point I had some like cable set up, and it was like in the basic package. But there's like documentaries. They have like I remember when I watched like 10 years ago, they had like some indie media stuff. I mean, every once in a while you'll see something really radical on there. They're always kind of like throwing different stuff into the mix. But yeah, like, what do you think it would take to get on something like Free Speech TV?
Well, I really don't know. I mean, back when we were making the show in 2008 around the Republican and Democratic conventions, the person who was running acquisitions was an anarchist, and they were actually showing a 30-minute version of the Stimulator show, of the It's the End of the World as We Know It, and did so for 2 years.
With cursing and everything?
Yeah, we're cursing everything. They would run it. They would run it after Democracy Now, like I think at 11:30 at night.
So it's like the late show.
It was like the late show, and during the both conventions, they ran all the shows that we created every night after we created them, because they also had setups in both Denver and St. Paul, and somebody emailed me and told me that. They have been running our A is for Anarchy series, which is basically like introductory series on anarchist concepts. And
really?
And so I know.
Wow.
Yeah. And so I hit them up and said like, hey, you guys mind giving me some money for that?
So they don't even tell you. They just throw it on there.
I mean, I really don't care about the money, because in the end, it will be negligible. I'm just more than happy that they're rebroadcasting. But I think that I don't think it's impossible. I just think whether or not they if they're into the content, they might do it. I mean, what we're doing right now is certainly no less radical than the Stimulator, but it's not so. There's not that much cursing. We try to do away with the cursing altogether, and we just couldn't fucking do it. Like it's just so much part of our of who we are. Yeah. But it's gonna feel more like a TV show. It's gonna feel more like 60 Minutes or something like that. I mean, not that level, that caliber of production, but certainly there's gonna be segments. There's gonna be a host. There's all these different things that use the same language as a sort of like a. That's a mainstream television news show, right? We'll see what happens. Like we're just gonna launch and hope that people take to the content first, and then we're gonna move on to figuring out other avenues for distribution.
Yeah, I think that's a big question. I mean, you brought up. I mean, obviously, Democracy Now! Has the Pacifica Network. I think you brought up a good point about people using public access, like the show on there. Obviously, like Alex Jones has grown off of, you know, different radio stations airing his program. So I think that's a big question. Like, how could anarchist media projects kind of use the existing infrastructure that's there? Like, could you get stuff on Pacifica networks? Could you get the show added onto public access? And like, what would that take?
I can tell you that Democracy Now! had a person, I mean, and it's probably more than one now, but they had a person dedicated to knocking on those doors, and that's something that neither of us, HeatScore or myself, had time to do. And so eventually it's trying to find somebody who will do it as a volunteer basis, or even finding some money to pay somebody to go knocking on those doors, right? Because I think generally you will find people who work in any sort of community media are coming from a left of center sort of perspective, and so it's not that far fetched when you show them something and say like, look, we'll bleep the show, we're giving you free content. You know, for radio stations, it's a sort of no brainer if they have a slot of time to fill that they don't have a radio producer for. Well, here's 30 minutes for free. Just put it on there, and that's.
Yeah.
That's basically what Democracy Now! Was offering people, which is super smart. And while I was working there, there were up to 800 stations.
Wow.
That were rebroadcasting Democracy Now!, and that was in 2006. Right now there are over 1,000 stations, and that's massive. And there was also a crew of people who were translating their headlines into Spanish and creating a Spanish version of the headlines for radio. And there was a person dedicated to knocking on doors of Spanish-speaking radio stations in Turtle Island, but also in Central and South America. And they were growing their network in that way. So that's we would love to be there, but first we have to make a solid show, and then we could start thinking about those other things.
But I mean, that's a real big thing that people could do. I mean, if you can't make media, if you can't do this or that, I mean, you know, get the show get the show played, get the show aired, and definitely, like, for instance, The Final Straw is expanding their radio network of radio stations that air their show. But I mean, that's a big thing that people can do, is expand that network.
Yeah, no, it's a brilliant move on their end, and I think that part of it is that they're creating a show that's formatted. I mean, they already do it on a radio station on Asheville FM, right? It's formatting the content to fit that, and if you're able to do that, then you're better positioned to have other outlets sort of run it. You know, I implore you, I implore the folks from the Which Side Are You On podcast, I implore the Crime Think folks, so anybody who thinks that they'd like to expand their operation to do it on radio. But that sort of that's also like a challenge, right? Like, you have to do it on a timely basis, right? If people are going to commit to rebroadcast your stuff, you have to commit to, like, give them a certain amount of content, whether it be weekly, daily, or monthly, right?
Yeah, exactly. Well, let's talk about anarchist media in general right now. What do you think we're doing well kind of in this moment, and where are we lacking in?
I think we're doing well with the fast sort of the fast analysis that's reacting to what's happening immediately, and we're doing really well in covering actions that are happening on the ground. As an aside, I've really haven't had such a huge desire to live in the United States as I do right now. It just seems like a really exciting time, and a lot of that excitement is generated by reading all the media that's coming out. And so it's been mind blowing, actually, that for the past couple of years, a lot of my news sources were coming just by scrolling my Facebook and Twitter feeds. And now, you know, I visit the Crime Think and it's going down sites almost on a daily basis, which is something that I know a lot of people are doing as well, right? That, you know, we're stepping off the sort of uber corporate sort of Facebook and Twitter sphere and actually visiting websites, which is something that people used to do. So some people used to do maybe like 10 years ago, people used to go to websites, you know, and not just read like the Facebook generated version of those websites.
Right.
I think on the podcasting and audio world that's growing. It's growing like in a really good way, and I think that people should be on the lookout for Channel Zero in the coming month or two.
You just want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. So this is actually I give full credit to Sol mm-hmm. of the Solcast and of his rap fame for getting us all together, but he basically got a bunch of the anarchist podcasters out there and convinced us that we should start a podcast network, and that's basically what it is. Channel Zero is going to be an anarchist podcast network that's going to have a website, that's going to have like a 24-hour loop of podcast playing nonstop, and so sort of like a one-stop shop for radical content. And so it's already growing, and we haven't even started. We're going to have the folks from the Black Autonomy Federation are going to be having a website there as well, and if people also know about other radical anarchist podcasts that should be part of a network, please let us know. I mean, maybe email. Yeah, it should be in the next month or so. We're still working on the web interface and all the little knickknacks, but hopefully by the end of April, beginning of May.
Yeah, Yeah, it's exciting. It's an exciting time. I feel like almost every day there's a new media project that pops up or somebody's doing something. So it's cool. It's great to see that. It's nice to have more stuff to listen to. What do you think about, I know IGD and Submedia and CrimeThink have collaborated a couple times, but what do you think in regards to like these projects working together, or even just like this Channel Zero thing? Like, what do you think the possibilities are for kind of putting our eggs in one basket?
I mean, I think it's certainly needed. I think that we all of us have different strengths, and it's been super sweet. This sort of happened, at least IGD, CrimeThink, and Submedia doing stuff together happened organically. Like, there was no sort of real intention at the beginning. It just kind of came around the Disrupt J20 actions that were happening, and we collaborated on stuff around then, and it just seems like a perfect fit, you know. Like, we have people who are really good at writing, we can crank out the videos fast, and we have outlets, we have website outlets to put it out, and it certainly gives visibility to all of our projects. You know, people who might come to Submedia might not know about It's Going Down. Then at the end, you know, that you see that It's Going Down is part of it, and as a result, you know, we all benefit from this. And so I think it's cool, but I also think it's cool that we all retain our autonomy. I think that centralization can be an issue, especially if we're all sort of centralized, and let's say we put all our eggs into one website, and that website gets taken out, that server gets stolen by the government or something, then you know we're left in the dark. And so it's good that we have things sort of spread around, but that we can still work together cooperatively, right? Because we're fucking anarchists, you know. we shouldn't be competing against each other, right? Like, we have different ways of doing things, but we're certainly we're sort of aiming for the same thing, which is total fucking liberation.
Right. Well, let's switch gears and let's talk about Montreal. I mean, you've lived all over. You grew up in Puerto Rico. You've lived in the United States. You lived in Vancouver. I mean, what is Montreal like? I just see pictures. It's like snow everywhere. It looks really cold. Can you just tell us about Montreal? I mean, there's a vibrant, vibrant anarchist movement there. So what is it? What is Montreal like? And yeah.
Well, I mean, according to some sources, it's the largest anarchist community in North America. Mm-hmm. But that's depending on who you ask. Montreal is a pretty interesting place with a specific historical context. I mean, it's a... for people who don't know, it's on the French Canadian province of Quebec. I will preface all this by saying that this territory here was shared by a number of indigenous communities, including Mohawks and Anishinaabes, Innus, Crees, etc. But the sort of colonizers of this area were from France, and when the Canadian state sort of took over Quebec, it sort of created a class war atmosphere here, where the Anglophones were sort of the ruling class, and the Francophones were the poor workers, and that created a class antagonism that manifested itself in something that's called the Quiet Revolution, it certainly had a pretty nationalistic flavor, but it was certainly a left-leaning revolution, and it created generations of left-wing folks, and so you have people here whose parents, people who were born in the 80s, whose parents were part of the Communist Party here before, and so you have as a result of these sort of like left-leaning struggles, great amount of services, funded services for women, great amount of universities that are super fucking cheap. So you'll find that the anarchist scene here is crazy educated. Like, everybody has college degrees, or everybody went to CGEP, which is the equivalent of a junior college. Mm-hmm. And within these universities, of a tremendous breeding ground for radicals and leftists and anarchists. And within these universities, you also have a tremendous amount of resources, so student levy fees that go into different departments and to also student unions. And so this is a place where it's fairly easy to organize. It's fairly easy to find locations to have events. It's fairly easy to find a photocopier to make posters. It's just so many things that you can say about it. There's political events here like almost every evening. There's actually something to do, a good speaker, a radical music night, radical film nights. This is happening like day in and day out, and it's a fantastic place to live if you can handle the cold fucking winter for 6 months. Then you're in for a treat. Because if people just want to get a taste for it, they should come to the Anarchist Book Fair, which is usually the third weekend in May. It's a weekend long thing. Starts on Friday night, it ends on Sunday. It's two buildings just jam packed with booksellers, and there's workshops, there's parties, there's speakers, there's a anarchist film festival, and this all takes place within the context of the Festival of Anarchy, which is usually the month of May, but in a few years it's been so big that they've actually gone over into June, and so it starts in May and it basically ends like on the first week of June with like daily events. On anything you can imagine, the International Anarchist Theater Festival, the Anarchist Film Festival, music, Art and Anarchy Festival, queer dance parties, barbecues, and if you're lucky, the year that you come, maybe there'll be a student strike, which is something that happens every few years, and
right.
And you get to experience one of the world famous Montreal riots. So,
yeah. What is the an interplay between I don't know how you would describe it, either the Quebec independence movement and also all these different native struggles? Like, how do the two view each other?
Well, it's interesting. There's a certain sort of problematic rhetoric that happens here in Quebec, which is partly based on truth. The French Canadians were not so so shy to intermix with the indigenous folks. Now, granted, a lot of this intermixing was violent, and you know, there was rape and all these different things. But there were certainly like a lot of couples, a lot of children that were born that were mixed indigenous and European, and so for a lot of indigenous folks is the independent movement is fucked up, right? Because it doesn't acknowledge the fact that all this land is stolen. You know, really there, Quebec doesn't really exist. You know, Quebec is a construct of European settler colonialism. Right.
Right.
But what a lot of the pro-independent people here say is that that everybody has like indigenous blood, and that's partly true to a sense, but like I said, a lot of that indigenous blood was obtained through violence and rape and all these different things. And so if I were to compare it to Vancouver, where indigenous folks are way more visible and way more present, I think the left here in general is still sort of like starting to make links with indigenous communities to do solidarity work. Now that's growing by leaps and bounds, and ever since I've been here, I've seen like great things happen. But there's still a tremendous a way to go before we're in a better spot. And specifically, if people start to acknowledge that we're all sort of living our lives in land that doesn't really belong to us, and how do we address this, and how do we move forward? Now that said, I think that when we think about where we live, I think that we I mean I taking it outside of the sort of Quebec context, I think people in the United States, people all over the Americas, have to always look at that first before they look at everything else. You know, I mean, I think all the struggles are important, but I think that when we look at where we are today, the birth of this sort of fucked up situation that we're living right now, when it comes to the Americas, if we're going to call them that, comes from settler colonialism, right? And so that applies to Quebec, but that applies to Oakland, it applies to Florida, it applies to Puerto Rico, it applies to anywhere else.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, I guess from my outsider looking in perspective, it seems there that the anarchist movement has very strong connections across Canada in Indigenous struggles. And I think that's maybe more just because the Indigenous struggles there are extremely militant and, you know, very powerful.
Yeah, but I also think that it's when you look at Canada from east to west too, is like you can see how the if you were compared to Pac-Man, like the Pac-Man of industrial civilization reached the West Coast last, and so as a result, you have way more indigenous communities that haven't been fully assimilated into the system of Canadian colonialism, right? And out here, certainly, especially in Montreal, where you have like two very big Mohawk communities very close by to the city, but they're still, I mean, they're strong. They're strong communities, really independent, with signs in front of the communities that say this is not Canada, you know, you're now entering indigenous territories, but they're still reserves, right? Or in this case of the states, they're called reservations, but they've still been sort of like given like a little tiny fraction, like, you know, minute, like I would say like less than 1% that the territory they used to call their own, to basically live out their lives with no possibility of growing that territory or expanding into territory that was previously theirs, right? And so that's something to keep in mind. Whereas in places like so-called British Columbia, you have loads of communities that have never signed treaties with the government, that still to this day have a legal right to like sort of vast lands of area, and who have actually, like, you know, say what you will about the legal processes, but this certainly helps in their case. They have the government approved sort of like legal framework to say, like, you know, like in the case of the Unist'ot'en, these pipelines, these oil pipelines cannot come through this territory because this is our traditional territory and it's been proven in the courts. And so it's I could go on and on for hours about this stuff, but it's a super interesting thing to look at, how the process of colonization, while it may seem that it's been fully consolidated in North America, it really hasn't. And you have these sort of huge sort of chunks of autonomous land that the cops don't go to, you know, that a lot of settlers can't go to, that, you know, it certainly gives me hope.
Yeah. I'm just picking back on that, you know, looking at the No Dapple struggle. I mean, this is what the first Trouble film will be about, the struggle in Standing Rock. I mean, I believe that the pipeline project now is operational. I mean, just looking back at Standing Rock, I mean, I'm just curious how the film portrays it. Like, a lot of people have said, like, yeah, it went through, but like this is giving birth to like all these other pipeline struggles. And I'm just curious, like, you know, in our heads, like how should we be thinking about this? Because with Trump coming in, I mean, there's going to be so many pipeline battles that are going to be fought. I mean, they're going to be trying to railroad through so many different things. And there are so many different pipeline fights going on right now in the United States and in Canada. It's almost hard to keep up with them. I wish there was actually more media coming out about the people that were fighting them. But I'm just curious, just kind of like how you see it, like the end of Standing Rock, you know, the struggle, the No Dapple struggle, or is it over? Or how do you feel about it?
I mean, it's over insofar as that the pipeline was built. I mean, I don't think that it's over insofar as people being able to stop both sections of that pipeline. I mean, like we've seen that in, and I'm not really advocating for anything, but I'm just saying, speaking here hypothetically and looking at other examples around the world, their pipelines are extremely vulnerable. I mean, they're not things that can be policed or surveilled, just because the sheer length that they take, you know. And and in recent years, we've seen just in the last year and a half, we've seen pipelines that are fully operational, that people were just able to cut a couple of locks and shut the valves down manually. I would preface that people who did these things knew what they were doing. They did the research to make sure that they were not caused like a spill or anything like that. But these things were done. Some of them were done publicly, as if to bring more attention in the media, and people locked down and they were arrested. But other ones were done in the cover of night, and were successful at shutting down the flows of oil, albeit for a short time. But you know, people also had to think that every time one of these things are done and these things sort of appear in the news, that there's market forces at play here, and that if people who invest their money into projects that are vulnerable to sabotage and might affect the return of their investment, they might be less likely to invest in those things. And even if forget about the sabotage and the sort of like illegal actions that could be happening, even if you're able to mount like a huge public resistance against one of these projects that brings a lot of a negative attention to these companies, companies are sometimes willing to cut their losses and take their money elsewhere, because they might not think that it's worth it to fight like this huge public battle for public opinion. And I will return to the west coast of so-called British Columbia, where a massive liquefied natural gas project by Shell was just recently shelved because of the huge opposition that it was facing, not just from indigenous folks, but all their allies all up and down the coast, who were just like saying they were willing to do anything to make the thing end. And so,
you know, is that Leilu Island?
Yeah, those are the folks from Leilu Island. Yeah, that project got shelved. Now, TransCanada said that, I think it was just today, they said that they were going to build a pipeline, even though there's no place for this pipeline to go, because they're hedging their bets that, you know, maybe eventually the project will return. And this is one thing that we have to keep in mind too, that sometimes we win these battles, but sometimes these companies return back and propose the same thing with some new modifications, right? Like, this is sort of like ongoing. But I think one of the things that we need a lot of is people who are really good at research and who are really good at researching who the companies are involved, who their subsidiaries, who their suppliers are. And one of the things that, to return to the folks in Unistone, and one of the things that helped them was that there's some folks who did some research and found out where these pipelines were going. And these people were able to get ahead of the long process of getting these pipelines approved and set up their autonomous village in the middle of the woods. And that thing is there to stay. That thing is not going to move, but they've had like 7 years to sort of set that up. And so it's that piece of infrastructure, if you want to call it that, because it's much more than that. It's also a tool for decolonization for folks who used to live in reservations to move back to the land. But it's hugely important in the sort of global picture, like that they're able to, like they're potentially stopping 13 oil and gas pipelines right now. Mm-hmm. And it took a tremendous amount of work, but part of it is because they had the information and they were able to start not during a crisis mode. It kind of reminds me of the last guest that you had on the show that talked about setting up infrastructure for against police repression, and when people are going to jail and all that stuff. It usually happens when we're in crisis mode, and that's really the most terrible time to sort of organize anything. And I think that maybe we should think strategically and think that, you know, yes, some of these pipeline projects are gonna get built. But maybe we can think about the ones that are coming maybe 5 or 10 years down the pike, and how do we set up infrastructures that are able to stop them. Now imagine if and you know, this is not to blame anybody for what's happening in Standing Rock, but imagine if people there would have started that resistance like even a year earlier, you know, mm-hmm. even 2 years earlier, you know, the amount of infrastructure that could have been set up that would have made it harder. And especially if they have, which is something we talk about on the first show, if they had agreed on frameworks for how they're going to fight this, so that they wouldn't be infighting about how to fight this while the fight has actually happened. That's also a hugely important thing.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit, because I think that'll be one of the big things that a lot of people will watch the first episode of Trouble about, just the question of tactics and the question of nonviolence. I mean, like, one of the things that IGD were always pushing is, like, you know, when can we get beyond this fucking liberal bullshit? Like, when can we actually just stop having this discussion about tactics? And to a certain degree, I mean, obviously we're always going to have these conversations, but when will kind of like the liberal, you know, kind of positions be kind of beat back a little bit, and people can kind of come out and be like, look, like, we're fighting against this, you know, it's going to look like a lot of different things.
I'm sorry to tell you, it's never going to end. It's never going to end. But what I can say for sure is that the more that, like, for instance, like the Standing Rock stuff happening just reminds me so much of 2010 in Canada, right, where the anti-Olympic movement happened and the anti-G20 resistance happened, and all of these things sort of came to a head. I mean, these are things that people try to preempt in 2008 during the Republican National Convention with the creation of the St. Paul principles, that were essentially the same principles that people came up with in Quebec City when the anti-globalization protests against the FTA, the Free Trade of the Americas, happened in Quebec City. The more that we build sort of this sort of robust, like, philosophical and political base, I guess, when these things come up, we're better prepared to fight it, because it's always going to happen. You know, it happened during Occupy Wall Street again. I mean, it happened during the Occupy Oakland protests, and we had this sort of wonderful debate between somebody from Crime Think and Chris Hedges, where, you know, that old man just certainly got owned, you know, partly because of his hubris and his arrogance, but partly because, you know, we've been talking about this shit forever. It's like there's one thing that we can count on is on the arrogance of the liberals who look at us as snot-nosed know-nothings, who just have like these sort of like desire to smash things, and
right,
and obviously it's not even about that, and so, you know, I think about this stuff in the same way that I think about everything that's happening right now, where imagine if people would have given up on anarchism, like when 9/11 happened, and just kind of said, like, well, you know, we lost, we throw up your hat, and then all of a sudden there's like this sort of anti-Trump resistance that's sort of coming straight out of the right at election night, right? And right. And these people would have had nowhere to go. They would have had no place to like find new ideas on how to fight this. But the fact that many people kept going, many people kept producing work, many people kept organizing, just showed that there's so many of us out there, and that we've never gone away. And the more of us that are out there who have these sort of understandings of tactics and strategies that are going to be the right ones that are going to get us to win, then the next time this stuff comes around, it's not that it's not going to be a no-brainer. It's certainly going to be annoying as fuck, as it is every single time, but it's going to be much easier to fight, because the arguments don't seem to change. They always seem to be the same sort of like knee jerk, you know, quote Gandhi, quote Martin Luther King. And, you know, that sort of like should shut us up. But, you know, when these people, when we encounter them, we basically show that their analysis is very shallow, and that, you know, we have the upper hand. And obviously, it's not about winning those debates. You know, it's about certainly winning in our struggles, but we certainly want to make sure that we spend a lot less time fighting those debates and a lot more time actually fighting the real fight, which is basically what ended up not happening in Standing Rock. You know, there was a lot of infighting, particularly because people didn't agree on tactics.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, it's hard. I mean, I feel like, you know, when I bump into liberals sometimes and I hear their, you know, their take on things, it's almost just like arguing with somebody that reads Breitbart and Alex Jones all day to a certain degree, because it's, you know, you're just like up against this wall of kind of like, you know, violence has never solved anything. It's like, really? like that's like your level of understanding? It's hard, but I think it's not even necessarily about them. It's about, like, you know, the base that they're trying to speak to, and like how they're trying to basically shut us up. And it's not really about winning the argument with them. It's about reaching out to the people that they're trying to influence and being like, look, like, this is why we're doing this. You know, this is why we're acting this way. But yeah, well, thanks for sharing that about the show. I mean, I really look forward to seeing the first documentary. Anything else you want to say about Trouble? Like any upcoming episodes, what the ideas will be? What are some of the things that you look forward to doing the show about?
Yeah, so we have the next two shows planned out. The second show is going to be into anti-fascist organizing, not just in the United States, but also in Canada and in Europe.
Cool.
And that's going to be an exciting one. And we're also doing one about support for migrants and in this new sort of age of Trump, but also looking at how people in Canada also support migrants over here. And in the near future, I mean, we have a bunch of different ideas, and we're always going to be looking for ideas, because we got to crank out at least 12 of these a year. But we want to do a one about surveillance. We also want to do a sort of retrospectives on movements. So we would love to do one about the student movement in Chile, for instance. That's a pretty amazing student movement down there. You know, go back to Greece at some point. That would be incredible. I mean, in the end, one of the goals of the show is that it doesn't become something with a very short shelf life. That it's something that, once we produce it, has an impact on the time that we're living right now, but maybe 2 years down the line, if you wanted to see how people were organizing against fascists in 2017, you can go back and watch that and still be able to learn something, and not have something that's so tied to the news cycle that, you know, after a week, nobody wants to watch it again, right? Because it's already old.
Exactly. Well, Frank, thanks so much for having us on. I mean, I am pumped about Trouble. I think it's going to be great. I think that just like you said, I think this is going to be an awesome, just easy event that people can organize. And like I said, too, there's the week Solidarity on April 1st to the 7th against repression. If you're looking for an easy event to put together, you know, showing this film definitely could be something that you could put on. Anything else you want to say? Anything that you're excited about media-wise or project-wise in general, or anything else you want to add?
Yeah, I mean, I can't say it enough. I'm really stoked at all the projects that have kept going after the Trump election, and how they've evolved into what they are now. I mean, the New Crime Think website kicks ass. I really love what y'all are doing. I've said this, and I will continue to say it. I'm very, very glad that it's going down. It's kicking ass. But there's also like Resonance Radio, which mm-hmm. is something that I think people should check into. Less sort of tied to the news cycle as well, but more creating audio versions of good text out there. And so if people just Google Resonance Radio Project, they should check that out. But also, like, I love music, and a good friend of mine does a radical music show called The Rebel Beat, and that's at The Rebel Beat Radio. I think we also more than just like resistance and sometimes like depressing stories. Sometimes we need good cultural output to to lift up our spirits, and so music is certainly one of those outlets. And and also stay tuned, we're going to have a new audio podcast ourselves focusing on radical hip-hop called Burning Cop Car, so wait for that.
Cool. I'm excited. There's a lot of stuff coming up, and glad that you all will keep pumping it out, and just super excited to see where it goes. And thanks so much for coming on. All right, Franklin Lopez, thank you for coming on, my friend, with the bouncy eyes all over the screen, saying obscenities all the time. I love it. Thank you, Frank, for gracing us with your presence. We're all really pumped for Trouble to come out. So if you're looking for an event for April 1st to the 7th in this global week of solidarity with people facing repression from Sacramento to Standing Rock to Washington, D.C., there is a ready-made event coming for you in several days with Trouble. Go on to Submedia, check out the film, set up a film screening, do a benefit, send some money to people. There's people all over the country that need money. There's people all over that need support. And remember, if you're planning an event, let us know. We're going to set up a post soon with different events happening across the United States and the world. So let's really get it out there. Every day, IGD is getting more and more hits. We're getting an insane amount of submissions, so please keep those things rolling in. It's great to see all this fucking shit going down all the time. Can't say it enough. And please, if you can, go on Tits Going Down. Drop a few bucks in our tip jar. Help us continue to grow. And for those that have not gotten It's Going Down t-shirt, I will let you know right now, since you are listening, the diehard, hardcore fans out there, we are almost out of the original press of our t-shirts. So if you want an It's Going Down t-shirt, you have not gotten one, now is the time to get one, because we are designing a new design. It's going to blow everything out of the water. So stay tuned, and thanks a lot for listening. And Frank, one more thing, since I know you're probably going to listen to this. You know, I love the hip hop, but here's some punk rock.
there is no God. A better leader won't come along. A better government does not exist. Just you and I.